We're speaking with Dr. David Pilgrim, who's the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Ferris State University in Big Rapids, but he's also the founder and curator of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia. Dr. Pilgrim will be speaking about the museum in Kalamazoo at Western Michigan University. Dr. Pilgrim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What exactly is the museum and how did it get started?
Oh, my goodness. I'm sure you don't have 3 hours, so I'll give you sort of the Reader's Digest version. Years and years ago, I started collecting objects that defamed African Americans. I've thought about this a thousand times. I'm not sure why I started. I was just always fascinated with everyday objects that depicted African Americans as mammies and toms and sambos. So I spent probably 30 years or so just traveling the country. I never had a lot of money, so when I traveled, I would just purchase those objects that I could afford and, you know, eventually amassed quite a collection. I came to Ferris State University in the early 90s and started the process of working with faculty and administrators trying to figure out how to best use the collection. For about 15 years, we were in a small, and by small, I mean a 500-foot square room. It was really just visible storage, but we did great work in there, and you could see the potential for the collection. A couple 3 years ago, I was fortunate enough to meet Fred Schell from DTE Energy Foundation. He understood that we weren't a shrine to racism, but what we were doing was using objects of intolerance to teach about race, race relations, and racism, but that in our limited space, we couldn't tell all the stories we needed to tell. And the foundation gave us a grant. It was matched by and exceeded by the university. And so April, I think, 2012, we opened to the a broader public.
Could you talk just a little bit about what you've mentioned in sort of passing, what kinds of objects you've collected, but is it quite a range of things? Or
yeah, in terms of functionality, we would have almost any everyday object you could name. So ashtrays, postcards, toys, games, whatnot, souvenirs, sheet music, just like I said, almost any everyday object one would think of. Those objects fit into some broad categories. Some you would call, you know, sort of caricatured objects. Others would be more segregation memorabilia. One of the things I'm pleased about in terms of moving into the new location was that we got to tell some additional stories. In a small space, we just told the stories of Jim Crow and told that with Jim Crow memorabilia. And segregation memorabilia, mostly, you know, signs like whites only or no color, that kind of thing. And then hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of caricatured objects. But in the new facility, now we have also a section on African-American achievement. And I'll tell you, it was a lot easier to reach into my pocket to pull out money to purchase, you know, an object, for example, about W.B. Du Bois, than some of the objects I had been paying for years. So we had sections on African Americans in the military, and of course, a section on the civil rights movement. So the collection is eclectic in many ways, but it basically allows us to tell the story of who was Jim Crow, what was Jim Crow, the relationship between Jim Crow and violence, the relationship between Jim Crow and caricatured objects. And then finally, as I just mentioned, sort of two or three stories about the African-American response to Jim Crow.
On the webpage for the museum, you mentioned that the prices for some of these objects, especially in more recent years, has really escalated and they've become considered to be collectible objects. That, frankly, is rather disturbing.
Well, I'll amend that because actually they've started to go down some here in the last few years with the popularity of eBay and other internet auction houses. But when I started, you know, when I was collecting in the 70s and certainly in the 80s, the prices just took off, in part because there were a couple of entrepreneurial collectors who started publishing price guides, and they'd stick a ridiculously high price on an object, and that became sort of the accepted value for that piece. And pieces that I had purchased for very little money at one point, a Mammy Cooker jar, like a McCoy, that I had purchased for, say, $2, got up to like $300, $400. But what eBay has done is soften those prices some. But my point, and we have a little section in the museum that talks about this, my point in that particular section is that all these objects have a secondary market value. So when you find a lynching postcard, it not only shapes and reflects attitudes, tastes, and values about lynching and about African Americans, but it's also a postcard. And it's a postcard that's purchased, that's sold and purchased, and not for a buck, but for $800 or $2,000 or for $5,000. So, the fact that prices, that that a value is placed on them at all, and especially a value disproportionate to the functionality of the piece, is certainly one of the, I agree with you, it's one of the more disturbing parts of this, but also one of the more interesting parts.
How does the museum use objects like the ones you've just talked about to improve tolerance and acceptance of people?
The main thing we do is place it in some context, so that it's not just an object. I think when people come to the museum, they are surprised that, they're surprised by the, quote, academic nature of the facility. So, we have placards, didactic panels that explain the history of a caricature, for example, and then a history of the object that's being caricatured. And so it's, you place it in a historical context. And then it's placed in the context of the racial politics of the time. And although I'm talking quite a bit now with you in the museum, if I'm doing my job correctly, I'm not doing a lot of talking at all. What the facility is an opportunity for people to learn. And again, there are lots of opportunities to learn if you simply just read the panels. But what it really is an opportunity to have people dialogue. And that's, as corny as it sounds, I still believe in the triumph of dialogue. And so you bring in someone, for example, who sees a Mammy cookie jar as sort of a vestige of slavery and segregation, and they're with some, in the same group with someone who sees it in a nostalgic kind of way, that reminded them of some good times as a child. The value of the museum, one of the values of the museum, is that you create a dialogue there. I was really pleased, and, of all the sections of the new museum, the one that pleases me the most probably is this little room of dialogue that we have, where we start there and talk about, try to get a sense of where people are, and then we have the experience going through the museum asking people, what is it you see? It's kind of a visual thinking strategies. What is it you see? What else do you see? Why do you say that? And the people, they talk about what they see. And then we go through, and I let people go through often in sections alone. And then we come back together, and then we dialogue about what they saw. And I think, as simple as that sounds, that it leads to some of the best conversations about race that you'll ever find.
Do you ever have people who mistake what the purpose of the museum is and think that it's actually promoting racism?
The farther away a person is from the actual museum, the more likely that is to occur. It hardly ever occurs with a person who actually visits the facility. But people who know us only as a concept, they read something in a newspaper or a magazine, and they haven't actually, maybe they haven't even visited the website, but they certainly haven't visited the actual facility, then we get a little bit of that, although not nearly as much as I once feared we would get. But I just don't get that at all with people in the museum. In terms of a negative response, the most common would be a kind of reflective sadness. And I always tell the people that work as facilitators, if that's where we leave people, with just a reflective sadness, then we failed. What this needs to be is a place where we have get a better, more accurate understanding of history, and by extension, you know, lays a solid foundation for intelligent discussion right now. But when we first opened, I mean, years and years and years ago, in the little 500 square foot place, that was one of my big concerns. But it just never panned out. I mean, it fortunately never panned out in that way. The people that worked as facilitators, you know, worked really hard to train them. And again, we didn't get as much of that as I had feared.
As we mentioned earlier, the museum started out as your personal collection of these kinds of objects. People who collect things, my assumption is that drawing from my own experience, that you collect things that give you pleasure. I can't imagine that these objects that you've been collecting give you any kind of pleasure. So personally, what kind of toll did this take on you?
Yeah, well, that's two different questions. Let me answer the first part. You know, because I think about that, let's use a different word instead of pleasure, satisfaction. You know, it's certainly the case that when I would find a great teaching piece, I mean, there was at least satisfaction there, because I would in my mind visualize what is it we can do, the kinds of discussions that will come from this. But I agree with where I think a part of your question is, that there was always some ambiguity with me, or ambivalence, rather. I mean, because there were times I'd drive, 200 miles to get someplace, and then be both disappointed that I didn't find something and also happy that I didn't find something, that kind of ambivalence. I think I was an obsessive collector because I had in my mind that, it evolved over the years, that I wanted to build an important collection, not so that it would gain me anything, but just because there were just so many stories to tell, and I didn't just want like little pieces here and there. I wanted to be able to tell the major stories. The other thing I was thinking when you were saying that is, I've also started collecting for the past 5 years objects that defame other groups, and so I'm always like trying to find the parallels, like both in terms of my own journey and my own experiences, but also parallels in the different pieces that I'm finding. And I can say that, I collect objects about, poor whites and Native Americans, gays, Arabs, recent immigrants, and all. And I still have the same ambivalence. In other words, on the one hand, I'm looking for something and happy to get it, and on the other hand, sad that the thing was created and what it represents.
Again, on the webpage for the museum, you allude to some interesting conversations, or in some cases, non-conversations with people as you were collecting these things from antique stores or places like that. What was that experience like?
First of all, I do less of that these days because of the internet. And that matters, because I'd probably be much better able to handle some situations than I did when I was much younger. I had some cases that weren't very good. I think I write about one where I was in LaPorte, Indiana, and there was a print that someone had framed. I think they had taken it out of an old book, but they had framed it, and it was a softly caricatured African-American child. It was an ink ad. And the caption read, "Nigger milk." And, I got into a little bit of a confrontation with the clerk in the store, the antique mall, because she wrote black print on the receipt. And for some reason, it was just really important to me that she write "nigger" ink print on there. And I just think it caught me at one of those times where the collection wore me down. And today, I would be wiser about that in a couple ways. One way is I would recognize that first of all, she didn't make it. And although she was the clerk, she no doubt was not the owner of the facility, and that I was projecting my frustrations with the existence of this thing onto her. And even practically speaking, it makes no sense as I found out many, many years ago, to get into an argument with a person and then end up not even being allowed to purchase the object because you've been thrown out of the place. So I had to learn how to collect. I had to learn how to have the interactions with the people that were selling objects. I mean, I would have people sell me grotesque, just vulgar depictions of African Americans and any number of, you know, plates or switch plates or ashtrays, whatever. And the person would say, you know, things that were, you know, racially insensitive. And I had to answer the question. I mean, was it important for me to purchase this or not? And was it at least important enough that I, you know, hold my comments until after I had, you know, received the object? So I had to learn how to manage my emotions. I had to learn how to manage those interactions.
The first object that you say that you bought when you were still quite young, just a grade school boy, you smashed. But obviously you went on and didn't smash.
Yeah, I didn't smash the second piece or the third one. Or, of course, I don't remember the second or the third one either. I don't know what was going on that day. I just think I was just, you know, a kid that saw something he didn't like and was acting out. I certainly had the desire to destroy pieces over the years, although I haven't intentionally destroyed one since then. You know, I've talked to African-Americans who collect this material. I've talked to Jewish-Americans who collect anti-Jewish material. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who collect, you know, sort of contemptible collectibles, if you will. And most of them, you know, I've had to come to some type of personal stance about, you know, whether these objects should be destroyed or preserved in some way. And the side I came out on that was, and I hope it doesn't sound elitist, but that these kind of objects either belong in a garbage can or a museum. And sometimes if you say that, then people that collect it for other reasons get angry. And they say, oh, that's a guy with a museum, so he's putting us down and condemning us. But I really do believe that their value would be as teaching tools. And certainly for me, you know, were I not using them as teaching tools or putting them in a place where someone else was using them as teaching tools, I think they should be destroyed.
What kind of person do you think would collect these kind of objects for some other reason?
Oh, there's lots of other reasons. I mean, probably the largest category of collectors are people that are speculators and investors. I still go to large black collectible shows. I mean, it's about money. It's they're dealers who buy and purchase, you know, hoping that something goes up in value. I mean, it's a market just like the baseball card market or any other classic car market. So that would be the biggest category. I mean, there's, you know, I've met so many types of collectors. You know, I met a guy once who I'd call a type collector. And by that I meant he collected tiles, like on your floor. And he just had to have every kind, you know, so he had literally thousands of them. And if you collect thousands of anything, especially from a period that overlaps with the Jim Crow period, you're going to eventually find some that are racist. And I don't think it had anything to do with his views about race, but he had several that would fit into my collection. You know, and I've seen that with people that collect ashtrays or people that collect banks, you know, same kind of thing. So, you know, and then, of course, you have people that collect because they are, how would you say, like mavericks. You know, people that don't want folks telling them what they can and can't do, and use it as a way of thumbing their nose at so-called political correctness. I think that would be especially the case with some of the newer objects. And I hasten to add, by the way, that there are no objects in the museum, although the objects in there go back many, 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 many years. There are no objects in there where the images are not still being created. They're either still being created as fake reproductions or they are just, you know, they've just morphed onto another object. For example, at one point, we had oysters in this country with the brand name Niggerhead Oysters, and eventually became Negro Head Oysters. Well, you know, you can buy mouse pads today where someone has taken the, you know, the label off the old can and reproduced it on a mouse pad. So all those images, I mean, despite the fact that, you know, this country has not been, I mean, we are as democratic and egalitarian today as we've ever been in this country. Nevertheless, those objects are still being made and sold. And actually, one of the more powerful parts of the museum is a section on objects that have been produced in the last 5 or 10 years. And, I mean, we could have a whole section just on President Obama. And I don't mean objects that just disagree with his policies. I mean objects that depict him as a monkey or as a Tom or as a Sambo or as a coon or some of these other harsh caricatures.
How do you think that this project, the museum and the collection, the collecting that led up to it, how has it affected you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, when it was pretty clear that the museum was going to be built, after 15 years of begging and trying to convince people that we weren't a shrine to racism, but that we would be an academic facility that facilitated intelligent discussions about race. And I was sitting in the, you know, the money had been approved, the board had approved their part, and the construction people were, you know, starting to put up some sections, and they had put up enough in the room of dialogue where I could actually sit in there on the little benches. And behind it is a mural of some people that were killed during the Civil Rights Movement, blacks and whites. And I was just thinking about the mural that was, you know, for that facility. And I think I just got really depressed. And I think in part it was because I felt like, you know, I realized that I had at some level thought that this was never going to happen, or worried that it was never going to happen, you know, and that now it actually was happening. I think there was also sort of, I don't know if fear is the right word, but a sense that, you know, I wasn't sure what came next. And so I think I actually lost my balance for about a couple weeks there, just trying to figure out, you know, basically what's next. So in terms of, I don't know if you want to call that negative or not, but in terms of the part that shook me the most, that was that, you know, actually getting near the finish line. In terms of positive sort of things, it just makes it a whole lot easier to do stuff I've been trying to do my whole life. I mean, it used to be the case, I don't teach courses here at the university anymore, but I meet with students a lot, and I lecture to students a lot. But it used to be when I would talk to students about, you know, Jim Crow, there was just this idea that, you know, that I was making it up, you know, or at least exaggerating. And now, you know, it's like a facility of evidence, you know. So it has made teaching a lot easier. Not just for me, but for, you know, the thousands of people that use the facility. Sort of, you know, when I was in, you know, when you're in high school and, you know, people, teachers make you read something. I mean, you're reading it, but you're not really reading it. At least I often did not. And so when I would read the writings of Dr. King, and so you'd read something like Letter from Birmingham Jail and that famous quote, which is almost a cliche now, you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I mean, I read that as a, you know, teenager, but I reread all of that stuff, you know, the last 5 or 10 years, and I really was profoundly impacted by it. And so I am really, really, really committed now to building a facility that, you know, that deals with sexism in our culture. And you know, I've probably already collected about somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 objects. And I don't know if you know, I'll be around if it gets finished or not. But I think that's a story that I want to help tell. And I don't think it dilutes, you know, the other story at all. I think it parallels it. And I, quite frankly, I think that I'll always be trying to tell these stories because I've just always felt that if you show me the objects, especially the bad ones, that are produced in a culture, I can tell you about the bad attitudes, tastes, and values in that culture. So that piece I wanted to add. And then the final thing I would say would be, you know, despite the fact that I deal with racist objects from the distant past, the recent past, and the present, I'm very optimistic about our culture. And that almost always surprises people. But I see us as, I mean, I just see the progress. And, you know, so anyway, I'll end with that.
David Pilgrim is the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Ferris State University, and he's also the founder and curator of the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia at Ferris State. He'll be speaking in Kalamazoo on Thursday, October 17th, in room 2008 at the Richmond Center for Visual Arts here at Western Michigan University. Dr. Pilgrim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.